On this edition of Celebrating Science, Leonard Susskind on information and black holes. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Black Hole Wars, Professor Leonard Susskind describes an intellectual battle with Stephen Hawking over the nature of black holes. He also describes strange paradoxes and puzzles about the quantum behavior of black holes and the things that fall into them. Professor Susskind is a theoretical physicist at Stanford University, particularly known for his work on string theory and the holographic principle. He is also the author of The Cosmic Landscape and is an associate faculty member at Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
Thank you. You're going to get the lowest tech presentation that you've probably ever had here. I'm a technophobe, one of these people who's afraid of new technology. I was going to tell you why, but I've been told that there are young people in the audience. Oh, what the hell, I'll tell you the story. When I was 25 years old, I was a very, very young physicist, and I was invited to Princeton University for the first time in my life to give a seminar. In fact, I think I was a graduate student, and I was scared as hell. Princeton, the Institute for Advanced Studies, I was terribly scared. And sitting in the front row was Murph Goldberg, a famous physicist, T.D. Lee, famous physicist, blah, 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 J. Robert Oppenheimer, famous man. Fortunately, Albert Einstein wasn't there. Anyway, he was dead. But this was his home. I mean, this was the place where he was. And so there were all, now I see Robert Brout in the front row. Robert, raising this scares me too, but I was terrified of these people, and I was a very young man. And my reaction to this kind of terror, as some people in the audience probably know and will testify to, is that instead of getting shy, I get sort of aggressive. And it's called passive-aggressive syndrome. And so I start pointing at people. So anyway, this guy Merv Goldberger, who was one of the very famous physicists there, asked me a question, which was not really hostile, but he was sort of probing me. And I got started to get very hostile in pointing at him and lecturing at him and lecturing at him in elementary quantum mechanics and so forth. Okay, now you have to understand, the machine that they had at that time, this was a long time ago, this was 1965, and they didn't have these fancy machines. They certainly didn't have anything like PowerPoint. They had things that were called opaque projectors. And opaque projectors, you fed a piece of paper in with a picture on it, and you had a handle that pulled it down. It was a sort of sandwich. Bright lights in there, which were quite hot, and they shined the opaque projector onto the blackboard. And you had this handle that you pushed down. That was part of the story. The other part of the story is my mother had just bought me a new suit for this purpose of this particular lecture, and she apparently bought me a rather cheap tie. Cheap red tie, remember the red tie? So anyway, there I am, pointing right at him, right? Just like I'm pointing at Robert Brout here, lecturing him like mad. In the meantime, with my other hand, I'm trying to control this machine and put the paper in. And what happens is I bend over, at that time I was quite thin, and my tie gets stuck in it, and the tie burst into flame. And Goldberger jumped up and threw water into my face to put it out. So anyway, the result of this has been a lifelong technophobia. That's the downside of it. The upside of it is that it taught me humility. In any case, tonight we're going to talk about the Black Hole War, or Black Hole Wars. The Black Hole Wars were a 25-year intellectual battle, a serious one, that involved not only myself and my comrade in arms, Gerard Tuft. Incidentally, Gerard Tuft is one of the great physicists of the century, and also Stephen Hawking. Gerard and myself were on one side. Gerard Etuft. Etuft is one of the few names you'll ever hear that begins with an apostrophe. It does. I'll write it out for you. And he and I were defending conservative physics, the conservative principles of physics, against this wild man, Stephen Hawking. And it took 25 years to sort it out. The black hole wars actually started in a rather odd place. They started in the San Francisco mansion of Werner Erhard. Does anybody, if you know the name Werner Erhard, applaud. Oh, good. Okay. This man was a guru of the self-promotion cult. But he loved physicists. In any case, I have a photograph here of myself, Gerard Tuft, and Stephen Hawking at a blackboard, where if you were to see the faces, it's from behind, if you were to see the faces, you would see the most incredibly strained looking, not angry, but just intense faces. Here's the photograph. It was taken from behind me. I don't like high-tech cameras. Until recently, I had such a photo, a real one, and I lost it, so I decided to just make one. The physicists in the audience recognize the black hole there. Everybody else, of course, recognizes Stephen Hawking. There it is. That's Stephen. This is Gerard Tuft, and that's me, and the person behind was taking the picture was actually Werner Erhard. Now, this took place in San Francisco. This was the first volley of the black hole wars. Stephen had announced something and told us something that both Gerard and myself reacted to almost violently, intellectually violently. We weren't going to throw Stephen out of his wheelchair. Let me tell you a little bit about the personality of these two people. Gerard is truly one of the great physicists of the 20th century. There is no question of that. In my mind, he, more than anybody else, carries the mantle of Einstein and Bohr. He's an extremely deep thinker. He is also a conservative. Like myself, I think he's a conservative physicist that, in a certain sense, doesn't really like new radical ideas. No new radical ideas until you've absolutely been forced to them. Now, if Stephen and I are somewhat, Gerard and I are somewhat conservative, Stephen Hawking is the evil Knievel of physics. He's the evil Knievel of physics in many ways. I'll tell you a little more about what happened in San Francisco. We all decided to take a little walk out in San Francisco on Telegraph Hill. Now, if you know San Francisco, you know that Telegraph Hill is a very steep hill. It's one of these fancy hills in break-busting crazy hills in San Francisco. And Stephen decided to come with us in his powered wheelchair. At that time, he could still talk. You couldn't understand him. It was hard to understand him, but he could still make sounds. And we get to the top of Telegraph Hill, and all of a sudden, Stephen is going down Telegraph Hill at 30 miles an hour, screaming, "Aah!" And we all panicked. We ran after him. We couldn't keep up with him. We get down to the bottom of the hill, and there's Stephen sitting there and smiling and saying, "Can we find another steeper one that he can try?" This is true. This is a true story. Stephen, in his physics, is very bold, very audacious, in very, very much the same way. He lives his life very fully, and he is the evil Knievel of physics. Like evil Knievel, he sometimes has his crashes. And we're going to talk about not a crash, something that he even concedes is wrong now, but the 25-year discussion that took place between us that ultimately, I think, taught us a great deal about the laws of nature and new things about space and time. Let's begin with what a black hole is. The oldest idea of what a black hole is, believe it or not, goes back to about 1780, when Laplace, does anybody know Laplace's first name? I've forgotten it. I don't remember. But Laplace is a, All right, he said it. He speaks French. Simone something, isn't it?
Pierre,
yeah. Laplace. And there was another gentleman by the name of Mitchell who actually did this first, but he wasn't as famous as Laplace, so very few people know about it. Laplace asked the following question. Every object, every planet, every star, and so forth, has something called an escape velocity. It's how fast you have to shoot an object off the surface of the star or off the surface of the object in order that it escape the gravitation of the object altogether, the escape velocity. The more massive the object, the larger the escape velocity. The smaller the object, for a given mass, the larger the escape velocity, because if it's all squeezed into a small distance, you have a harder problem getting away from it because everything has gotten squashed and you're close to it. So what Laplace asked is, what would happen if we had a star which was so dense and so heavy and so small that the escape velocity from the surface of it was the speed of light or even greater than the speed of light? Then even light couldn't get out. And if light couldn't get out, then this object would appear as a dark star and couldn't be seen because the light could never get out. This was the first example. You don't need these equations here. I'll just very quickly tell you. What this winds up telling you, the size of the dark star has to be proportional to its mass. Don't worry about the equations. But it tells you something about the size of a dark star in terms of its mass. And this was the first inkling that such a thing as a black hole could exist. Now, I'll give you another picture of a black hole. It was Einstein's picture of gravity. All of this, of course, has to do with gravity. What Einstein said was... I told you I'm not a high-tech guy. What Einstein said is gravity is some sort of warping of space-time, which gives it curvature. An ordinary star is just a little dimple in space-time, a black hole or a dark star. Can everybody see this little ring that's around here, this little slight gray ring? I didn't make it dark enough. Is it possible to see? Yeah, okay, good. A black hole, by contrast, is a great big dimple with a nasty point at the end of it that if you fall into, you hit that point and you get skewered on it. But it also has something called a horizon that goes around it, and the horizon is such that if you fall behind the horizon, you're screwed. You're going to get, excuse me, there's young people here. If you fall behind the horizon, you're going to wind up getting skewered on that. So that's what a black hole was according to Einstein gravity. This is not what I want you to think of as a black hole, because space-time geometry is a complicated subject. I'm going to give you instead a metaphor or an analogy for it, which I actually find helpful when I think about it. Imagine an infinite lake, a lake that just fills all of a flat planet over the whole space of it. There's the water. Okay, it's rather shallow. Fish live in it. These fish communicate with each other, and they communicate with each other with sound. They can't see. They're blind. There is no light. In this world, there is no light. They communicate with each other with sound. And furthermore, there's a rule. I don't know whether it's a rule of nature or if it's a law that the fish passed, but the rule is no fish is allowed to go faster than the speed of sound. Nothing in this system can go faster than the speed of sound. That's the rule. Now, right at the center of the lake, there's a drain hole. And the drain hole is opening up and letting the water flow through. And guess where it goes? It goes to a sharp rock at the bottom so that anything that falls through this hole is again destroyed on these hard rocks here, these nasty hard rocks. Well, if you go far away, you'll find that the fluid is moving very slowly. As you move closer and closer and closer, the fluid is moving faster and faster. And eventually you come to a place where the fluid is moving as fast as anything else can move. In other words, where it's moving with the speed of sound. That means that a fish that gets in there can't get out. The fluid is falling faster. The water is falling faster than a fish can swim. Not only that, since it's falling faster than sound can propagate, that fish can't even signal his outside friends that he's there. The sound will fall back down. It's being pulled down by the infalling water. So that ring there, that place where the velocity exceeds the speed of sound, that is a point of no return. Anything that falls past there is doomed. Now, a fish that is just floating freely will have no idea that it's passing this point of no return. Nothing special happens there. Just floats past it and only finds out that he's doomed later. There's nothing extraordinary. There are no signposts there that say point of no return or danger or anything like that. He just floats on its back down there and suddenly finds himself in bad trouble, but there's nothing special going on, and that place is the horizon. This is the black hole. The bottom, the nasty place, is the singularity, the place where you really do get ripped to pieces. And this white line here where the velocity of the fluid becomes the velocity of sound, that's analogous, very precisely analogous, to the horizon of a black hole. Okay, that's everything you have to know about black holes. That is it. That's what a black hole is. Of course, it's space which is moving. It's not fluid which is moving. It's space which is falling in. But that's the picture. Now, years later, after the black hole had been discovered, people started thinking about the thermodynamics of black holes. I'll tell you what that means in a minute. About black holes and heat, and about black holes and quantum mechanics. The first idea that there's something interesting and peculiar about black holes having to do with heat came from Jacob Bekenstein in 1972. Jacob Bekenstein is an Israeli physicist, a very famous Israeli physicist, and he asked an interesting question. He asked about the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says entropy always increases. What is entropy? We'll come to what entropy is, but whatever it is, it's got to do with heat. It's got to do with substances which have been heated. The entropy of the world always increases. It's roughly speaking the statement that confusion always gets worse. And what Bekenstein said is, he said, wait a minute. I can make the entropy of the world, or the world that I'm in contact with, I can make it disappear. I can just take a box of hot gas, full of molecules, full of entropy, and let it float down and fall into this black hole. Once it's behind the horizon, I will never see it again, I can never feel it again, I can never have any contact, and effectively it's out of my world. And since it's out of my world, effectively the entropy of my world has decreased. He said that violates the second law of thermodynamics, that the entropy should decrease, and his solution to it was what it must mean is that a black hole itself has entropy, that the picture was that anything that falls into the black hole increases the size of the black hole a little bit, adds some mass to it, adds some size to it, and somehow the black hole itself has entropy, and because it has gotten bigger, the entropy must be increasing. He made some rough calculations and concluded that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the area of the horizon. Very interesting. But it doesn't mean anything to anybody unless you know what entropy is, right? So now I will tell you what entropy is. Here's an example, a perfect example of entropy. Here's a bathtub. It's full of hot water. A bathtub full of hot water, how do you describe it? You describe it by its temperature, by the amount of water in it, maybe the pressure of the water, a few things. That's about all. But there's an enormous amount of going on in that water that you can't see. It's the molecular structure of the water. There's an enormous amount of information in that water about each individual molecule. The position of every individual molecule is a piece of information, but it's hidden information. It's hidden because you're too coarse-grained. You're too big, you're too gross, you're too big to be able to see it. It's hidden information. What entropy is hidden information that you can't see because it's in microscopic things that you can't see. Here's a technical statement, it doesn't matter what it means. Entropy is hidden information stored in things because you can't see them. Well, that has an interesting, and there's something interesting going on. If black holes have entropy, which is what Bekenstein had to say in order to rescue the second law of thermodynamics, That means several things. First of all, it means they have a heat content. Entropy is always associated with heat. So it must mean that black holes have some heat associated with them. They have some energy associated with them. Just good old Einstein's E equals mc squared says that a black hole has some energy. Anything that has both energy and entropy automatically has a temperature. The temperature is the energy divided by the entropy, basically. And so what Hawking realized is that Jacob Bekenstein's entropy idea implied that a black hole has a temperature, that it's not a frozen cold object. And what do things with temperature do? They radiate. They radiate energy the same way a hot poker that was left in the fire radiates some light. No matter how cool a thing is, as long as it has any temperature at all, it will radiate away some energy. But if it radiates away energy, that means it's radiating away its mass. And if it radiates away its mass, it means it shrinks. And so what Hawking realized was that black holes eventually evaporate. They disappear. This is all preliminary to the black hole war. These are the preliminaries that went into the story. Oh, yes, I think I may have mentioned on the other slide, the entropy of the black hole is proportional to its surface area. That's very strange. If you think about the temperature, if you think about the bathtub full of hot water, and you ask how much information you can hide, basically it's the number of molecules. And the number of molecules is always proportional to the volume. In all systems that anybody ever knew about, the ability to hide information was always proportional to the volume. How many molecules are there in this room? Well, it's proportional to the volume. What Bekenstein found was that the entropy of the black hole was proportional to its area. Very strange, as if there was nothing inside the black hole. People studied black holes extensively after that, and they learned some things about black holes which were surprising. From the point of view of the fish falling past the point of no return, there's nothing special at the horizon. But from the point of view of somebody outside a black hole doing experiments on the black hole, it seems as if at the surface of the black hole, at the horizon of the black hole, there are all sorts of things going on. The fish or a human being falling through would see nothing, and yet the description from outside the black hole, and here's the kind of things you could do. You could take the temperature of the black hole by dropping a thermometer down near the surface of it. What you would discover is the temperature gets hotter and hotter and hotter as you get down near the surface of the black hole. This is weird because remember, the fish floating through feels nothing special happening, and yet a thermometer which is supported and can be pulled back up registers a temperature that grows and grows and grows as you get close to the horizon. You could do an electrical experiment where you make a circuit and you put the leads down near the horizon, and you would discover the horizon behaves like an electrical conductor. That seemed very strange. Nothing going on at the horizon, and yet it's behaving like an electrical conductor. The horizon has temperature, it has entropy, it has all of these phenomena, and yet, from the point of view of somebody falling through, nothing is there. This was a puzzle, and the question that people would ask is there really something there at the horizon, or isn't there really not something there? And the conclusion of most physicists is that this was illusory. There's nothing really at the horizon, and to test it, you could fall through the horizon and see that there's nothing there. But on the other hand, you could test it from the outside and discover there was something there. This was a great puzzle. It was part of the puzzle that led to the black hole war. And it led to a very, very serious conflict of principle between two fundamental principles of physics. One is called the equivalence principle. For our purposes, the equivalence principle means no more than fish falling through the point of no return feel nothing and do fall into the center. This is an imaginary black hole. Vertically, I've plotted time. Here is the horizon of the black hole, and here is a fish falling into the black hole with time. And right at the center is the nasty singularity where it's bound to get killed. Okay, so this fish just sails right through, and if that fish happens to carry any information with it, such as the Encyclopedia Britannica or anything that it's carrying with it, that information will go right behind the horizon. Once it goes behind the horizon here, it cannot get out. Black holes cannot, or the horizon of black holes are a one-way thing. You cannot get back out, not without exceeding the speed of light. On the other hand, all of this radiation is coming out of the black hole. This is the stuff that Hawking discovered. Hawking discovered that black holes radiate, and as they radiate, they give off energy. So it seems, if Hawking is correct, that information falls into the black hole and cannot get out, and yet the energy does get out in the form of this Hawking radiation. Why is this a puzzle? It's a puzzle because it means that information is lost, truly lost. And this is something which, in all of physics up till the present time, was never allowed. Real information is always there in the system, no matter how scrambled it gets, no matter how hard it is to recover. The information in a hot bath of water is there. If you could study every molecule, you would discover everything that ever happened to that bath. And here was Hawking saying something really new. He was saying that when you have a black hole around, information is truly lost. There's a process that takes place in the black hole that completely wipes out the past. It completely wipes out any information in the past. And this is what disturbed Herodotus and myself. Why did it disturb us? Because this violated everything we knew about physics. Ordinarily in physics, information is never lost. It may be scrambled, but it is never destroyed. Herod and myself believed Stephen was wrong. Stephen believed he was right, but it became a kind of Mexican standoff. We couldn't figure out what was wrong with his argument, and he certainly didn't believe us. 25 years went by of arguing. Let me phrase it to you another way. Let me give you two stories, and let's to see if we can decide among us by taking a vote which of the two stories is correct. Both of these stories involve throwing somebody into a black hole. Oh, you like that? Oh, okay. I have another one if you like that. I have a few more, but it will take us all night. Let me tell you, what I tried to do, I wanted to tell a joke here. So I asked my friends, who is the dumbest, most disliked politician in Canada? Because I wanted to have one more with a Canadian on it. And they scratched and they thought, and nobody could come up with an answer. Is this true? Come on, Rob. All right, so here's the question. This was serious. There appear to be two discrepant stories that come from two different principles of physics. According to one principle of physics, anybody who falls through a black hole experiences nothing special at the horizon, nothing at all, and simply falls through as happy as they ever were until they get near the singularity, where they get crushed, where they get mutilated, where they get destroyed, where they get the where that's one story. I'm imagining a black hole which is so large that when somebody falls through it, they can survive for 100 million years, for example. 1 million years, excuse me. For 1 million years, a million light year black hole. Condi here can survive for 1 million years and encounters nothing special at the horizon. Now there's another story. The other story comes from Hawking's and Bekenstein's conclusion that there's a heat content on the surface of the black hole, and also Bill Unruh's contribution. And their contribution said, Bekenstein's and particularly Unruh's, that very near the surface of the black hole, it is hot. That's where all of this entropy is. The temperature gets higher and higher as you get down close to it. And in that picture, Condi here falls in. And when she gets nearer and nearer to the surface of the horizon, she gets cooked. She gets evaporated. She gets ionized and eventually turned into just hot photons which go out. These were the two pictures which look totally irreconcilable, cannot possibly be the same, and yet one law of physics, namely the conservation of information, that nothing ever gets lost, must say that Condi's bits get spit out by the black hole before they ever fell in. And the other picture, which is the equivalence principle, says nothing special happens at the horizon. So now we will take a vote. How many people, let's do this as a voice vote, how many people think that Condi survives until she hits the singularity?
She's a politician, she's going to survive.
No, I can never get people to vote. Raise your hand if you think she survives. Okay, good. How many people think she gets it at the, she gets her just desserts at the horizon? Oh, okay, more at the horizon than at the, that's interesting. So which, you read here, I realize now I understand. This is one of my favorite quotes of Sherlock Holmes. I knew him well. When you have eliminated all that is impossible, whatever remains must be the truth, no matter how improbable. The answer is, in a certain sense, that we'll try to make clear, both stories are true, but it depends on who's telling them. What did Bill Clinton say? It depends on what is means? All right. A new concept has arisen in physics that says both of these stories are true in a certain sense, and that new concept is called black hole complementarity. This is one of the things which has come out of this great debate. Incidentally, I mean, Stephen and I and Farad argued and argued and argued and argued, and eventually I and Farad just agreed with each other, nobody else, that this must be what's going on. Somehow both stories are true. So we introduced an idea called black hole complementarity. What is complementarity? Complementarity is a concept in physics that goes back to Niels Bohr. So let me tell you what it says, what the kind of thing it says. It's very interesting. Niels Bohr was interested in conflicting descriptions, descriptions of things which apparently conflicted. For example, light is a wave. How do you see that light is a wave? You see interference patterns when you send light through little holes. It makes patterns that look like wave patterns. Light is a wave. On the other hand, if you send light through very, very slowly, meaning a very, very dilute beam of light, you attenuate the light somehow, put a lot of filters in the way or something like that, then you find out that the light arrives on the screen over here as little pieces, little bits, photons, quanta, particles. Light is a wave and light is a particle. No, wrong language. Light is a wave or light is a particle, depending on the experiment that you do. This is what Niels Bohr taught us. Depending on the experiment that you do, light may behave as a wave or it may behave as a particle. The quantitative story that goes with the particles here is that the energy of these little quanta depend on the frequency of the light wave through Planck's constant, E equals h nu. This is one example of complementarity where two apparently irreconcilable descriptions of something, you can say they're both true, but I wouldn't want to say it is a wave and it is a particle. I would want to say it is a wave or a particle, depending on the experiment that you do. That's the first example of complementarity. I'll give you two more. A second example has to do with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Anybody here who's never heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? A few people. All right. Well, most people have heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, if they're certainly if they have a scientific background. But I'll tell you very simply what it says. If you have an object, that object typically has a position, a location in space, my fist. Right? It also typically has a velocity. In order to know what's going to happen to it next, you have to know where it is and how it's moving. And so in classical physics, one always assumed that objects have both position and velocity, and, A-N-D. An object has a position and a velocity. What Heisenberg showed is that any time you try to measure the position of an object, you do it with light. The light consists of quanta. You can only see the position of a particle if you use a very short wavelength quanta. You cannot see the location of a thing accurately by using long wavelength radio waves. If you want to see something accurately, you've got to use short wavelengths. And the quanta that make up the short wavelength light ray have a great deal of energy. And so every time a quanta hits this object, it gives it a kick, and it changes the velocity. So what Heisenberg understood, and what Bohr after him understood, was that particles don't have, or objects don't have, positions and velocities. Depending on what experiment you do, you either describe them as having a position or a velocity. And this was quantified by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which said the uncertainty in the position times the uncertainty in the momentum or the velocity is something like Planck's constant, or bigger than Planck's constant. This is another example where two descriptions are complementary and where the right idea is or rather than and. Let me give you a third one. An event. My event here is the explosion of a bomb. Okay? An event has a time, it happens at some time, and it has an energy, the amount of energy released by the bomb, for example. Or it could be an elementary particle decaying, a neutron coming and decaying into an electron and a proton. I didn't draw the neutrino, but you can't see neutrinos. right. Okay. A particle decaying. It happens at a time and it gives off a certain amount of energy. So it has a time and an energy. No, it doesn't have a time and an energy. It has a time or an energy. If you precisely know the time that it decays, it must mean that the energy is very, very big and uncertain. If you know the energy of the object, it means that the time of that it will decay is very uncertain. So here's another example of where or has to replace and. You can either describe it as having an energy or a time, but not both. You can't measure both. Now we come to black holes. Black holes, we have a similar kind of puzzle. We have another situation where we would like to say, perhaps would like to say and, but and doesn't make sense. Here's the situation. Fish are falling into the black hole, and they're carrying their information with them. It goes behind the horizon. So the information must be eventually behind the horizon. Why? Because the horizon is not a special place to the infalling fish. On the other hand, another principle of physics tells us that information can never be lost, so somebody out here must be able to detect that same information, that same fact that a fish fell in, by studying very, very carefully the evaporation products, Hawking's evaporation products that come out. So we could say a bit of information is behind the horizon, and the same bit of information is in front of the horizon. But that's not something that's allowed in quantum mechanics. You can't have the same bit of information twice. However, you might say there's a bit of information in behind the horizon or a bit of information in front of the horizon, in the sense that two completely distinct experiments done by this infalling fish, which can never be communicated to the outside, or experiments on the outside, which can't be communicated to the inside, we'll modify that in a minute, can never talk to each other. So no contradiction can be derived. It's one or the other, depending on which experiment can be done. This is a classic example of Bohr's complementarity. Are you with me? Yeah? Okay, let's go on then. I could stop for questions here, but since you're all with me. But then there's an interesting question. Supposing this lady here, who collects the bit of information that the fish fell in, collects it in the Hawking radiation, decides to jump into the black hole with that bit, holding that bit in her pocketbook. Okay. Now we have two bits of information, presumably the same information, both behind the horizon. Now this fish could send a message to this lady here, and she would discover two versions of exactly the same thing. This is bad. I'm going to tell you why. I wasn't going to tell you why this is bad, but let me tell you why this is bad. This woman over here might have made a measurement which was equivalent to measuring the position of the fish. The fish might send the message telling her what its velocity was. And now this lady would know the forbidden information of both the position and the velocity. This is the reason that you cannot have the same bit of information in two places. It would violate the uncertainty principle. And so you can't have both bits, but could there be a sense in which there's an or? It's either this or this. Could there be a reason why this fish behind the horizon could never send a message to this woman in front of the horizon? Well, if you think about it, if this fish tries to send a message and is behind the horizon, this message gets swept along with the space and falls to the singularity, just like the hole in the lake. That message gets swept to the singularity where it's destroyed. So that means the fish must send its message very quickly after passing the horizon, extremely quickly, right immediately after passing the horizon, if it wants to get the message to this lady there. But if it's going to send the message that quickly, it had better be armed with a clock. And that clock had better tell it, you had better send the message instantly after sending the passing the horizon here. And that clock has to be extremely accurate. Unfortunately, if that clock is very accurate, that clock must also have an enormous mass. That's, again, this energy-time uncertainty principle that says that if you know the energy of something, the mass must be, or the energy, if you know the energy of something, the time must be completely uncertain. And if you know the time, the energy must be completely uncertain. That means for this fish to send that message in the form of a photon, it had better have a huge reservoir of energy in the form of a clock. In fact, how big an energy? Its energy must be e to the square of the mass of the black hole. Enormous. An object that big cannot fit into a black hole, and so there is no way that you can run into a contradiction this way. Somehow Hawking was missing this. He didn't understand that. We had a hard time explaining it to him, but eventually we explained it to him. And the result is, again, that there's no question of a contradiction. It's either one experiment or the other experiment. Either you're the fish or you're this woman. In one case, you see the bit on the outside. In the other case, you see the bit on the inside. This was really shocking. This was very, very strange for most people, and they had a hard time accepting it, that the same bit of information could be in two very, very different places. Now, let's see, we still have a bit of time. Yeah, okay. How could it possibly be that the same thing could be so confused about where it is, the bit of information carried by and what does it have to do with string theory? And what does it have to do with string theory? That's the question. What do they have to do with string theory? All right, so the first thing that I want to explain has to do with clocks near a black hole. If you're outside a black hole and you're watching a clock, the clock slows down. This is one of the funny things that Einstein discovered, that clocks slow down in a gravitational field. The closer the clock gets to the horizon, the slower and slower and slower it seems to go. You see the clock going very slowly. Now, what does that have to do with dogs? Dogs can hear sounds that people can't hear. They can hear extremely high-frequency sounds because their ears are attuned to high-frequency sounds. And so they can hear a whistle, a high-frequency whistle, that you can't hear. But now take that whistle and take it in close to the black hole horizon and listen to it from the outside. The whistle seems to slow down. The whistle seems to go. The whistle near the black hole is seen as going slower, or is heard as going slower. And so the person on the outside suddenly, as the whistle gets closer and closer to the horizon, suddenly begins to hear it, suddenly begins to sense the very, very high frequency oscillations of the whistle that they couldn't sense when the whistle was not near the black hole horizon. Okay. What does this have to do with strings? What it has to do with strings is that strings oscillate and vibrate in the same way that whistles do. You cannot hear or see or detect their very, very high frequency oscillations unless they get close to a black hole, in which case you on the outside can suddenly start to be sensitive to the very, very rapid fluctuations of string theory. I'm not going to tell you what string theory is. All I'm going to tell you is the implications of this, and they're very strange. Instead of hearing the string, you see the string, and the way that you see the string is with the Hawking radiation, but that doesn't matter. You see it oscillate more and more with higher frequency oscillations, and as it does so, if you're watching it from the outside, it seems to oscillate more and more, and vibrate with bigger and bigger vibrations until it's spread over the whole entire black hole. On the other hand, imagine yourself now falling through the horizon with the whistle. Whistle, let's go back to whistles. You're falling through. You do not get to hear the whistle because you're falling through with the whistle. So you don't get the benefit of this funny effect on clocks. And the result is somebody who is falling through with this string does not get to see the string spread out over the horizon. Well, this sounds like exactly the right kind of thing. Two completely different descriptions, one from the outside and one from somebody falling through. And string theory has this property that the place where the information is depends on your state of motion. If you're outside or if you're falling through, you see two totally different ways that the string is distributed. That's all I'm going to tell you about string theory, except that the modern picture of black holes, or one of the modern picture of black holes, the horizon, is represented by an incredible tangle of string. That string is there to anybody on the outside and looks at it, and it's exactly this tangle of string which is the microscopic structure, the microscopic degrees of freedom which are carrying all this entropy. They're the atoms of the black hole of the bathtub full of hot water, except they're all distributed on the surface. They're not on the interior. This turned out to be an important part of the resolution of this paradox. But the only thing I want to say about it is not only was it an example of Bohr's complementarity, but it's a totally new and really wild example of relativity, a new kind of relativity, not ordinary old-fashioned Einstein relativity. Old-fashioned Einstein relativity, special relativity, said that certain things are relative to the state of motion. For example, if two flash bulbs go off and we ask if they go off at the same instant, then anybody who studied the special theory of relativity that knows that that depends on whether the observer is moving or not. A moving observer will see two flash bulbs not go off at the same instant of time, even though an observer at rest sees the two flash bulbs go off at the same time. Simultaneity is relative. But Einstein would never have gone so far as to say a flash bulb inside a soup can. Let's make this a soup can. A flash bulb inside a soup can is seen as a flash bulb outside a soup can by an observer who's moving in some funny way. If the flash bulb was inside, it's inside. If it's outside, it's outside. There would be no confusion in the standard theory of relativity. But here we're finding something new, that the answer to the question of whether a bit of information is inside a black hole or outside of a black hole depends on whether it's being studied by somebody outside the black hole or somebody falling through. This was something radically new. It's teaching us something very strange about space and time, something totally unexpected. I think I'm not going to go through all of my transparencies here. There are too many of them. But the last thing I'm going to tell you about is something called the holographic principle. The holographic principle was an even stranger development that grew out of the black hole wars. Again, it was something that Atuft and I put forward around 1993, 94. Here's the idea. Supposing you have a region of space, this room, and I want to know how much information can be hidden in the molecular structure of this room. Roughly speaking, how many molecules do you have to know the answer, how many questions do you have to know the answer to know everything about this room? Well, one way the physicists might attack this is to divide the room up into little cells, tiny little cells, and reduce the question, all questions about the room, to a question in each cell. Is there a particle in there? Isn't there a particle in there? Let's make the cells small enough so that you can't jam two atoms in. And then we could completely know everything that's going on in this room if we knew whether every cell was occupied or not occupied. That's one way that physicists have to go going about studying the properties of a system like this room, is to divide it into little cells. How many possibilities are there? How many bits of information? In other words, how many answers do you need in order to know everything? Well, the number of answers that you need is proportional to the volume, the number of cells. The maximum number of bits that you can hide is almost always proportional to the volume. Planckian just means the littlest, smallest cell you can imagine. And this is a very deep and basic principle of physics that's always been true. Missing information, entropy, proportional to volume. But what Bekenstein had taught us is that the missing information of a black hole is proportional to its area. Well, a black hole is the object which is hiding the maximum amount of information for its size. And that meant that the maximum amount of information that you could hide in a region of space is proportional to its area, not proportional to its volume. The area is much smaller than the volume for most systems. If this room is 1,000 inches by 1,000 inches, let's say, then 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 is a billion cubic inches. Right? On the other hand, the area is only 1,000 times 1,000. That's only 1,000,000. So the area is much less than the volume. But what physics was telling us, and the black holes were telling us, and what Bekenstein was telling us, is the amount of information that you need to describe a system is only proportional to the area of the walls. The implication of this is very strange. Does everybody know the word voxels? Everybody know the word pixels? Pixels is what you get if you take an image or a picture and divide it up into cells and make each cell have some discrete piece of information in it. So a photograph of something or a painting of something can be divided up into pixels, and the number of pixels is proportional to the area. Some people use the word voxels to describe what would happen if you divide the world into tiny little cells, each of certain volume. Right? The number of voxels is proportional to the volume, the number of pixels is proportional to the area. What this new principle was saying is in some way, everything that takes place in a region of space is described not by dividing the world into voxels, but dividing the boundary of the world into pixels. In other words, in some funny way, some new way, everything that goes on in the world can be described by only those things which go on in the surface. It's a hologram. It is some kind of hologram, some kind of new hologram that describes everything in three-dimensional space as if it were on a two-dimensional film. On the boundaries of the world. This is an idea which at first was met with a great deal of skepticism, but in the end, I'm not even going to tell you what this picture is, but it's so lovely that I have to show it. It's got nothing to do with the lecture. The experts in the audience will recognize it as anti-de Sitter space. I'm not even going to tell you what it is. What I am going to tell you is that string theorists eventually put some very, very hard mathematics, hard not in the sense of difficult, but hard in the sense of precise, on these ideas, so that all of these ideas have now emerged as part of the bedrock foundation, not just of string theory, but much of modern physics. Black hole complementarity, the holographic principle that the world is described by the things going on its boundary, These have become, over the last 5, 6, 7, 10 years, these have become part of the bedrock foundation of physics. The black hole war, well, the black hole war has ended. Stephen has very graciously conceded that he was wrong. He not only graciously conceded he was wrong, but he graciously told us that he would tell us how he figured all of this out. So the black hole war is ended. Information does get out of black holes. The holographic principle seems to be a part of physics that's going to stay with us. What its implications will be, particularly for cosmology, particularly for the whole universe and so forth, we don't know yet. But one of its implications is that basic quantum mechanics, the rules of quantum mechanics, the rules of information conservation will not have to be given up. Once again, the conservatives have won. Thank you.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.